The seasoned and award-winning journalist Ross Gelbspan has investigated the coal and utility industries after finding them casting doubt on the science of climate change. Here Gelbspan speaks at the Vic EnviroFest 2008 on March 20th in Toronto, Canada.
Hi, thank you all so very much for coming out tonight and coming in from this beautiful evening to hear about this god-awful weather we're probably going to be talking about. I really want to thank all of you, but I especially also want to thank Lindsay and Joanna and Rosa and Leo and especially Professor Homer Dixon for their hospitality. It really is a treat to be here. I'm going to take a quick minute just to give you a little more of a sense of where I'm coming from here. As Joanna mentioned, I am a journalist. I'm not an environmentalist. I didn't get into this issue because I love the trees. I tolerate the trees. I got into this issue because I learned that the coal industry was paying some scientists under the table to say nothing's happening to the climate. And I said to myself, if this cover-up is going on, what are they covering up? And there went the next 10 years of my life. So the impulse that propelled me into this work has nothing to do with the love of nature. It comes from a very deeply held belief on which I predicated a 30-year career that in a democracy we need honest information on which to base our decisions, and in this case, some very large interests have been stealing our reality. And I know in my bones and from all my experience, this bodes very badly for the democracy, and it turns out that it also bodes very badly for the planet as well. A couple of years ago, Time magazine ran a cover story on global warming under the headline, "Be worried, be very worried." Today, I think that message is a bit obsolete. I think it should be brave, be very brave. We are standing at the threshold of runaway climate change, and the coming disruptions, which many scientists now say are inevitable, will likely lead us either into a future of totalitarianism or into a new and unprecedented era of human solidarity. But first, a word from our sponsors. This climate crisis has been visited on all of us by huge coal and oil companies that have blocked meaningful action on this issue for at least 20 years. Most regrettably, they have a powerful accomplice in a negligent and largely indifferent U.S. press that has done a dismal job in preparing the public for this issue. Nature is telling us to cut our use of coal and oil by 80%, and much of the rest of the world is listening. Holland, Britain, Germany, and France are already beginning to cut their emissions by 50 to 80% in the next 45 years. But this is something you'd hardly know from our national news outlets. In the U.S., big coal and big oil have a stranglehold on Washington, and their influence has muted U.S. press coverage as well. So if meaningful change is going to happen, we have to push it upwards from the grassroots into the national consciousness. This puts a very difficult and a very unfair burden on all of us, but it also puts people working at the grassroots in a particularly strategic position. For one thing, people working locally will not have operatives from the carbon lobby putting their fingers in their eyes. And while the coal and oil lobbies have paralyzed action at the federal level in the U.S. and to a lesser extent here in Canada, they just don't have enough foot soldiers to stifle action in localities all around the countries. Those of you who are teachers or students are particularly well-positioned. Our schools are seedbeds for social change. We look to our colleges and universities for new ideas and new directions. So if you can raise awareness of this issue at your school, that message will reverberate throughout the larger community. It's also not that hard for students to get access to local news outlets. So when you talk to reporters, you can explain that when you cut your use of carbon fuels, you are not only cleaning up your own neighborhoods, you are also helping people halfway around the world whose crops are destroyed by weather extremes, whose homelands are going under from rising sea levels, and whose borders will be overrun by environmental refugees. I'm not going to go through all the climate impacts and scientific findings that are surfacing almost on a weekly basis in the literature, but I'd like to offer three large-gauge observations about the climate crisis. The first is its speed. We have all been absolutely blindsided by global warming. Global warming didn't even surface as a public issue until 1988. That was the year that the United Nations made the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change. That was the same year that NASA scientist Jim Hansen went before Congress in the U.S. and declared that global warming is at hand. Today, a mere 20 years later, scientists are telling us that we are approaching or already at a point of no return in terms of staving off climate chaos. That is an incredibly short period of time. The blink of an eye, historically speaking, for such massive changes in these large planetary systems. As Harvard's Dr. Paul Epstein said to me recently, we are seeing impacts today that we didn't project to see until 2085. The second point, and this is one that presents one of the most difficult aspects of communicating the challenge, has to do with lag times and feedbacks. Carbon dioxide stays up in the atmosphere for about 100 years, so many of the impacts that we're seeing today are likely the result of emissions we put up in the 70s and 80s before India and China began to ramp up their surge of coal-fired industrialization. And I'm afraid that makes it virtually inevitable that we will see more events of the magnitude of Katrina and the European heat wave of 2003. The issue is further compounded by the existence of feedbacks in which small changes in certain planetary systems trigger very large changes in other ones. For example, the tundra in Siberia and Alaska for thousands of years has absorbed methane and carbon dioxide and locked it into its frozen terrain. Now that tundra is beginning to thaw and release those gases back into the atmosphere, and that could well trigger a new spike in heating. The third point I wanted to make involves the extreme sensitivity of Earth's systems to just a very tiny bit of warming. As we know, the glaciers are melting, the deep oceans are heating, violent weather's increasing, the timing of the seasons is changing, and all over the world, birds, plants, fish, insects, and animals are migrating toward the poles in search of stable temperatures, and all that has happened from 1 degree Fahrenheit of warming. And for context, we're looking forward to a century of 4 to 10 degrees Fahrenheit. What we need is a rapid worldwide switch to non-carbon energy, to wind and solar and tidal and wave power and ultimately hydrogen fuels, and we need it yesterday. That does not mean we all have to sit in the dark and ride bicycles. Those sources can give us all the energy we use today and more. The fossil fuel lobby knows that better than perhaps anyone else, and its response has been to protect the industry at the expense of the rest of us in general, and more specifically, at the expense of the lifeblood of any democratic system, which is honest information. For more than a decade, the carbon lobby has mounted a very effective campaign of deception and disinformation, most intensively inside the U.S., to persuade the public and policymakers that this issue is stuck in uncertainty. That campaign, for the longest time, targeted the science, and in so doing, it marginalized the findings of more than 2,000 scientists from 100 countries reporting to the UN in what is the largest and most rigorously peer-reviewed scientific collaboration in history. That same campaign also misrepresented the economics of an energy transition, and now with its champion in the White House, it has attempted to demolish the diplomatic foundations of the Climate Convention, and it has been very effective inside the U.S. From the perspective of an investigative reporter, the central drama underlying this issue is crystal clear. It pits the ability of this planet to support a complex civilization versus the survival of one of the largest commercial enterprises in history. The oil and coal industries together does about $1 trillion a year in commerce. In this battle, their resources are virtually without limit. And I want to give you a few examples of what I'm talking about. In the early 90s, the coal industry launched a disinformation campaign using a few greenhouse skeptics, three of whom received about $1 million over a three-year period under the table that was never publicly disclosed until we published it. That was in the early 90s. Understand, these people are extremely persistent. We received a new memo about a year ago from a group of coal companies about the launch of yet another disinformation campaign, producing a major movie to counteract Al Gore's film, increasing support for U.S. Senator James Inhofe, who calls global warming the biggest hoax ever perpetrated on the American public, and to buy more airtime for yet more skeptics. This manufactured denial is by far the biggest obstacle facing all of us who are working on this issue. Launched more than a decade ago by the coal industry, it has been carried forward more recently than by the oil industry, which has spent something like $25 million since 1988 to bankroll these skeptics and their institutions. ExxonMobil has been a particularly active player in this game. In 2001, the head of the IPCC, Dr. Robert Watson, suggested that the U.S. might not be doing quite as much as it could to help deal with the climate crisis. As a result, ExxonMobil sent a memo to President Bush telling him to get rid of Watson, and in short order, Watson was out of a job. ExxonMobil also made it clear that it strongly opposed any U.S. involvement in the Kyoto Protocol. So when President Bush formally withdrew the U.S. from Kyoto, the White House sent several notes to ExxonMobil thanking the company for its active involvement in helping shape the administration's climate policies. The oil industry's fingerprint on the administration's climate policies surfaced again 2 years ago. Early in his administration, President Bush appointed an attorney from the American Petroleum Institute to head up the White House climate office. When that appointee, Phil Cooney, was found to have altered a major scientific report by deleting lots of references to coming impacts, he was forced to resign from the White House. 4 days later, he was hired by ExxonMobil. As recently as last summer, the company moved to further distort public policy. The previous February, 86 evangelical ministers urged strong action on global warming for two reasons. One, to help preserve God's creation, and the second, which I found very worthwhile, was to protect the most vulnerable among us, poor people in developing countries, from the impacts of climate shocks. That was followed 6 months later by a statement from a separate and previously unknown group of evangelicals who proclaimed that climate change is God's will and that it's not going to be that bad anyway. And it turns out that this new coalition received $3 million in funding from ExxonMobil. Basically, this group was created by the oil company. And last year, of course, Vice President Cheney, who has very intimate ties with the coal industry, declared, "We need a big debate to determine the real cause of climate change," as though it had not been settled by more than 2,000 scientists more than a decade earlier. The big debate we need, of course, is not about the cause of climate change. It needs to be about how we organize ourselves in anticipation of a coming era of collapse. At this point, regrettably, that debate is still on hold because several key constituencies have not yet exhibited the courage to face up to this reality. To be sure, the climate crisis is generating a supercharged sense of desperation among activists as well as among some of the world's most prominent climate scientists. But the activists are telling us only one part of the truth, while a number of scientists are proposing schemes, some of which are half-baked, unrealistic, and in some cases reckless. While both groups, moreover, are focusing on the environmental consequences of intensified warming, few are bothering to consider its impacts on the democratic process. In the U.S., virtually all the national and grassroots climate groups are pushing hard to reduce carbon emissions. But even assuming the wildest imaginable success of their initiatives, that humanity began tomorrow to replace its coal and oil with non-carbon energy sources, it would still be too late to avert major, major disruptions. Even Al Gore, who has done a wonderful job of bringing this issue to public attention, continues to peddle the notion that we can solve this problem. We can't. We have failed to meet nature's deadline. And in the next few years, this world will be experiencing progressively more ominous and destabilizing changes. These will happen either incrementally or in sudden and abrupt jumps. But under either scenario, it seems inevitable that we will be confronted by crop failures, by water shortages, by increasing damages from extreme weather events, and potentially by a series of breakdowns in our civic lives. In the face of this reality, the large Washington-based environmental groups are fighting over which piece of rhetorically impressive but practically toothless climate legislation to support in the U.S. Senate. The disconnect is really striking when you consider that within the last 2 years, a number of leading scientists, Rajendra Pachauri, who's head of the IPCC, British ecologist James Lovelock, and NASA's Jim Hansen, have all declared that humanity is either past or is about to pass the tipping point in terms of global warming. The IPCC recently declared it is very unlikely that we will avoid an era of dangerous climate change. Far more likely, the panel said, is that we will experience a series of abrupt and irreversible changes. In fact, we may be already witnessing the early stages of runaway climate change, and Dr. Homer Dixon will talk about this in some detail, I imagine, in the melting of the Arctic, in the increase in storm intensity, the accelerating extinctions of species, and the prolonged nature of recurring droughts.
You are listening to Ross Gelbspan, a major American journalist who follows the global warming debate.
Many scientists, moreover, fear that the warming is taking on its own momentum, driven by internal feedbacks that are independent of the human-generated carbon layer. Given this reality, the hollow optimism of the environmental establishment, I think, is diverting us from focusing on the survival requirements of the human enterprise. Among scientists, the panic is expressing itself in several rather dubious geoengineering proposals, which would basically allow us to keep burning coal and oil. Nobel laureate Paul Crutzen, for example, has proposed, with some others, spraying aerosols into the upper atmosphere to reduce the amount of sunlight hitting Earth. Unfortunately, the seeding of the atmosphere with sun-reflecting particles would also trigger a global drought, according to other researchers. James Lovelock, the British ecologist, recently proposed installing deep water pumps on the floor of the ocean, pipes to bring cold water to the surface to enhance the ocean's ability to absorb carbon dioxide. Others suggest the dumping of iron filings into the ocean to increase the growth of algae that would absorb more CO2. Neither of these proposals, as I read them, considers any other impacts on ocean dynamics or marine ecosystems. What these scientists are really offering are technological expressions of their own desperation. But in trying to geoengineer our way around nature's roadblock, they are failing to acknowledge their ignorance, all of our ignorances, about unintended consequences. And almost inevitably, when we tamper with nature in ways we don't really understand, nature comes back and bites us in the backside. To be fair, the reality that faces us all is extremely difficult to deal with, as much from an existential as from a scientific point of view. Climate change won't kill all of us, but it will dramatically impact the human population through the spread of infectious disease, the collapse of agriculture in various areas, the increasing scarcity of drinking water, and so forth. Those problems will be dramatically intensified by an influx of environmental refugees whose homelands no longer provide viable living conditions. Last spring, the U.S. Army War College declared that climate change represents an extremely serious threat to national security because of impending resource conflicts and chaotic refugee migrations. An increasingly inflamed climate will also put our tradition of democracy, corrupted as it already is, even at further risk. When governments are confronted by breakdowns, they are forced to resort to totalitarian measures to keep order in the face of chaos, and that is the only choice they have. And since carbon dioxide has an atmospheric half-life of 100 years, it is not hard to imagine a short-term state of emergency morphing into a long-term state of siege. So one frequently overlooked potential casualty of accelerating climate change may, in fact, be the democratic process itself. Add the escalating squeeze on our oil supplies, which could intensify our meanest aspects, and you have the ingredients for a long period of repression and conflict. I think the antidote to that kind of future lies in a strengthening of our civic ties and a revitalization of government, an elevation of public mission above private interest, and an end to the free market fundamentalism that has blinded much of the U.S. public with its mindless belief in the divine power of markets. In short, it requires a revival of a system of participatory democracy which reflects our fundamental social and moral values rather than the priorities of the corporate state into which we have slid. From a more personal point of view, an acknowledgement of the reality of escalating climate change plays havoc with one's sense of future. It's almost as though a lone ocean voyager were suddenly to lose sight of the North Star. It deprives one of an inner sense of navigation. To live without at least an open-ended sense of future, even if it's not an optimistic one, is to open oneself to a morass of conflicting impulses, from the perverse anticipation of a plunge into hedonism to a demoralizing feeling that a lifelong guiding sense of purpose has evaporated. There needs to be another kind of thinking that centers neither on the profoundly dishonest denial of the oil and coal companies, the misleading optimism of the environmental establishment, or the fatalistic indifference of the majority of people who just don't want to know. I think there needs to be a vision that accommodates both the truth of the coming cataclysm and the profoundly human need for a sense of future. And that vision, I think, needs to be framed by the truly global nature of the problem. It starts with the recognition that this historical era of nationalism has become increasingly toxic and an impediment to our collective future. We all need to begin to think of ourselves now as citizens of one profoundly distressed planet. A clean environment is a basic human right. And without it, all the other human rights for which we have fought so hard will end up as grotesque caricatures of some of our deepest aspirations. One hopeful accident of timing is that the climate crisis does coincide with other trends. Like it or not, the economy is becoming truly globalized. The globalization of communications makes it possible for anyone anywhere in the world to communicate with anyone anywhere else. That, to me, is a breathtaking development. And since it's no respecter of national boundaries, the global climate makes us one. Every part of the world is going to be feeling different kinds of impacts. At the most superficial level, I think the coming changes clearly indicate that, to the extent possible, we should be eating locally and regionally grown food to minimize the CO2 generated by factory farming and long-distance food transport. We should also be taking our energy from a decentralized system using whatever non-carbon technologies are best suited to their natural surroundings. Solar in sunny areas, wave and tidal power in coastal areas, wind farms in the wind corridors, and geothermal almost everywhere. And it might even be possible to maintain a low-level coal-fired grid, say of about 15% of current capacity, as a backup for days the wind doesn't blow or the sun doesn't shine. But it seems critical to stop thinking in terms of centralized energy systems and begin to think in terms of local decentralized technologies. At the level of social organization, the coming changes to me imply the need to conduct something like 80% of our governance at the local grassroots level through some sort of consensual democratic process, and the remaining 20% by representatives at the global level. For some years, I've been promoting a policy bundle of three specific strategies as one model of how to jumpstart this global energy transition. These policies are spelled out in this book, Boiling Point, and also on my website, heatisonline.org. I'll tell you very briefly the three elements. One is withdrawing subsidies for oil and coal. The industrial countries spend about $250 billion a year subsidizing oil and coal. We're saying take those subsidies away from fossil fuels and put the same subsidies behind clean energy technologies. The second element involves creating a fund of about $300 billion a year, maybe through a small tax on global commerce, to transfer clean energy to poor countries, virtually all of whom would love to go solar. And the third is a mechanism within the Kyoto framework that could cause each country to increase its fossil fuel efficiency by 5% a year until the 80% reductions are achieved. I'm not going to talk any more about them. If you're interested, maybe we can have a minute or two during the question period. The initial impulse behind these strategies was to craft a policy bundle to stabilize the climate and at the same time to create millions and millions of jobs in developing countries. One just key fact comes from a former executive director of the World Bank who makes the point that every dollar invested in energy in a developing country creates far more jobs and far more wealth than the same dollar invested in any other sector of their economy. So initially, we envisioned these solutions as a way to undermine the economic desperation that gives rise to so much anti-Western sentiment. They would, we hoped, turn impoverished and dependent countries into trading partners. They would raise living standards abroad without compromising ours. They would jump the renewable energy industry into a central driving engine of growth of the global economy. And ultimately, they would yield a far more equitable, secure, and prosperous world. Unfortunately, given all the years of apathy, indifference, and hostility to the climate threat, nature has now relegated the plan's initial goal of climate stabilization to the rearview mirror. But this kind of public works plan, this global public works plan, if initiated in the near term, could still provide a platform to bring the people of the world together around a common global project that transcends traditional alliances and national antagonisms, even in today's profoundly fractured and combative and degraded world. Along the way, it could also provide decentralized standalone energy sources for diminished communities in a post-crash world. As outlandish as it sounds, I do believe this kind of project could even provide the platform for a new and very proactive period of peace. The key to our survival as a civil species lies in an enhanced sense of community. If we maintain the fiction that we can thrive as isolated individuals, we will find ourselves at the same emotional dead end as the current crop of survivalists. An existence marked by defensiveness and mistrust and suspicion and fear. As nature washes away our resources, overwhelms our infrastructures, our survival will depend increasingly on our willingness to join together as a global community. As one Argentine climate negotiator said, we are all in the same boat, and there's no way half the boat is going to sink. To keep ourselves afloat, I think it's critical that we change the economic and political structures that determine how we behave. We need to elevate the ethic of cooperation over the reflex of competition. We need to elevate our biological similarities over our geographical differences. We need to prepare together for a very difficult future. But we also need to realize that nature may unintentionally be giving us an unprecedented opportunity to reshape and reprioritize the human enterprise. Nature may very well be giving us one more chance to try one more time to finally get it right. There is no body of expertise, no authoritative answers for this one. We are crossing a threshold into uncharted territory. And since there is no precedent to guide us, we are left with only our own hearts to consult, whatever courage we can muster, the intellectual integrity to look reality in the eye, and an uncompromising dedication to a human future that reflects the combined aspirations of every single person in this room. So thank you all so much for coming here.
That was journalist Ross Gelbspan speaking at the Vic Envirofest 2008, March 20th in Toronto, Canada. He is the author of the book Boiling Point, How Politicians, Big Oil and Coal, Journalists and Activists Are Fueling the Climate Crisis and What We Can Do to Avert Disaster, published by Basic Books. Gelbspan maintains a very informative website at www.heatisonline.org. That is, heatisonline.org. This recording was made by John Paul Warren, with editing and presentation by Alex Smith of Radio EcoShock. Find our latest programs and archives at ecoshock.org.